He was known as the Bear, because he did actually move like a bear, very slowly, very deliberately.
When a man wears denim, the aftershave that's as cool as the clothes he wears, he makes an interesting discovery. The more he puts on, the cooler he gets.
He was really the voice of choice for a lot of ads for films.
The perception was that only men could sell things to people, you know, because they were butch and they were forceful and they said, buy it today.
Sometimes I feel that I would like to grab Bill's voice box and then shove it into another human or something just to get that voice, because the voice was Bill.
We were born on the same day, and I was born on his birthday, so we just say we were the best birthday present I ever had, Junior. And we had quite a lot of character traits in common, but I'm glad I don't have all of the madness in common.
In advertising, they say sex sells, and one of the sexiest sounds ever employed to sell a product was the voice of Bill Mitchell, probably. Bill was an extraordinary man with this incredible ultra-masculine voice that was in constant demand.
Cool. Hard. Smooth. Desired by women. And men.
I'm Miriam Margolyes, and in the 1970s I was one of that special breed of actors, like Bill, who became known more for their voice than their looks. I, for example, played the sexy West Country rabbit, who seduced a whole battery of woodland creatures as I languidly unwrapped a chocolate bar. Although, in real life, I actually have quite small ears. Bill didn't look exactly how he sounded either. He was a big man, more cuddly than hunky, with an idiosyncratic dress sense. Bill's friend, actor and voiceover artist, Chris Sanford.
Bill Mitchell dressed entirely in black. Black hat, black shirt, black jacket, black trousers, black shoes, black socks, and dark glasses. If anyone ever asked him why he wore dark glasses, he would lean very close to them and he'd say, "Because your beauty is too blinding."
So where did that voice come from?
When I was about 12 years old and my voice was changing, I got the mumps. I actually used to be a coloratura. And I was silent for approximately 3 weeks. That's how I took up drinking, really. Because
I used to talk like... I can't do it anymore.
It's injurious. And my voice changed at the same time I got the mumps. So I was silent for about 3 weeks, and then suddenly I opened my mouth, and this came out.
Are you a fan of Superman 1 and 2? Well, I'm 1-2. And now there's two super movies in one super program. Superman 1 and 2. At a cinema near you. Certificate A. One superhero. Two super movies. Why not take the whole family and give them the old 1-2?
Bill had a difficult childhood, and his newfound manly voice gave him a free pass into the adult world of nightclubs and bars, which he eagerly embraced, embarking on a life of drinking and smoking to keep his new superpowered voice in shape. Bill's friend, musician Zoot Money.
Well, he was from Toronto. Nuns looked after him for a while and tried to straighten him up, sort him out. And they tried the Canadian Navy, where he was notorious for being reprimanded for dumb insolence. And he just couldn't be put into any kind of straitjacket at all.
Bill was born William Mitchell McAllister Brightstein in Montreal, Canada, in 1934. His mother was, as Bill put it, a Jewish princess from Buffalo, New York. His father was a Scottish seaman who'd met his mother on holiday but who hadn't stayed around. Bill was educated at a Roman Catholic school and, following his mother's death in a road accident, grew up in a Catholic orphanage. At 14, Bill joined the Canadian Merchant Navy, as much to see less of Canada as to see more of the world. Bill's daughter, Amanda McAllister.
There was always sort of lots of confusion around his origins, and I think that's because he told a variety of stories about them. But as far as I know, from my mother, and then consequently a little bit later from an ex-girlfriend in Canada, he did come over seeking acting work because he wanted to be an actor.
Arriving in Britain in the late 1950s after a spell in a Spanish jail for brawling and a fondly recalled period as a bouncer at a brothel, Bill quickly gravitated to London's Soho, meeting like-minded souls like the musicians Kenny Clayton and Zoot Money, who formed a trio with Bill, the Flying Falconis.
A three-piece entertaining group, I suppose you could call it. That's me on piano, or Kenny on piano, or both together at some stages, and Bill adding the words to standards, changing the words to standards to suit the event. And we called it the Flying Falconis, meaning we work without a net. In fact, we work without an audience if we have to. And heckling was absolutely paramount. Each other, heckling each other, or managing to fend off hecklers. Between the three of us, we could handle almost any heckler.
Despite Bill's claims only to sing in the key of Z, they would happily perform their party piece, a version of The Lady is a Tramp, with lyrics altered to suit any occasion, anywhere in Soho, at the drop of Bill's big black hat. Bill found occasional acting work, often playing heavies or Americans in British films, until, as he put it, after nearly 40 years on holiday, somebody paid him to sound like he did. Chris Sanford again.
When I first started doing voiceovers, it wasn't considered the thing that an actor did. There were only about four or five of us doing it. There was Ray Brooks, there was Gary Watson, there was myself, two or three others, and we seemed to do everything. And I was lucky because I can shift my voice. So, you know, for one person I'd be doing the Daily Mirror, another person I'd be doing the American Express card, another company I'd be doing the voice of a chimpanzee. Some of them were very, very good at it. Some of the big names were excellent, of course. And then there were some that used to say, I can't do that. I don't know how do you get all those words into 30 seconds? And I'd say, I don't know. It's either a gift or a disease. I haven't decided which yet.
Ah, the chimpanzees. I was very good at them. It's all in the big mouth movements. It's the taste. TV advertising had taken a little time finding its feet in Britain, with many of the earliest advertisements from the mid-1950s sounding more like public information films, with clipped, authoritative voices calmly espousing the virtues of their products. Slowly, though, advertisers had begun to inject more personality into their adverts, wanting to associate their wares with humour, and for that they needed voices with a bit more character. Bill's first advertising voiceovers in the late 1960s were for Pan Am, giving the airline a suitably transatlantic feel, but his unique voice soon found itself attached to a whole range of products, from Cadbury's Flake to Seiko watches.
Bill became very necessary because he didn't have an American-sounding voice at the time that was authentic. And, of course, he's Canadian, but he was able to put the right nuances on all the pronunciations that they wanted. He could also do very light, high voices, but Bill cornered the market on denim for men, that kind of sound, and he actually developed his way of getting that sound.
One of Bill's most prominent voiceover jobs was as the voice of Carlsberg, probably, which he took over when original voiceover artist Orson Welles became just too expensive. Producer Nick Angel worked with Bill Mitchell on commercials in the 70s and 80s.
Bill was, you know, certainly in the UK, as far as I know, the only person that could get even close to the depth that Orson Welles had, the intonation. From time to time, they got Bill in to do the line or to do something on Carlsberg. Certainly there was this kind of confusion, is that Orson Welles, is that Bill? I think possibly on the back of that, there were times where Bill almost adopted a whole kind of Orson Welles persona.
This is one of those commercials for again. We thought that by not saying we would be ringing the changes and adding a bit of variety. In fact, in the second half of that last sentence, you may have noticed we didn't mention Once.
I think it's very important to understand that, and this is particularly prevalent as far as Bill is concerned, that it is an amazing skill, really, to understand timing, intonation, emphasis, and really being able to sort of successfully deliver a message.
The fire glows warmly in the grate. Your chair is comfortable. You are at ease, relaxed. Nothing can disturb you, can it? After all, it's an everyday world. No undue ripples on the tranquil waters of your life. Yet the day must draw to a close, and night is as inevitable as death. But you are safe. Of that you are certain. You are safe. Aren't you? You did lock the door. Latch the windows.
Bill on a Dracula album recorded with Christopher Lee in 1974, giving us his horror voice, using the microphone with the expertise he was famous for. Sound engineer Rob Townsend worked with Bill Mitchell in the 1980s. He remembers working with Bill to pick out that deep, rich tone.
Once you had that sweet spot, the compressor took it and made more of it, so it expanded it, and it was just wonderful to work with. The moment I knew it was going to be Bill Mitchell walking through the door, I knew, for example, what EQ settings I should have on the desk, because I knew it was Bill. It worked a dream, every time.
Bill's voice didn't just inspire terror or awe, it also conveyed wit, and now and again stirred a little ardour in its listeners. Bill's daughter, Amanda.
I do remember he used to get quite a lot of fan mail sent to the radio stations in various places, and some of them that were smart enough to track him down and know that he drank in the Coach and Horses at Soho and things. There was an awful lot of sort of love letters and fan mail left for him everywhere. And he was very naughty. He used to send them back postcards of tramps on benches and things like that. He never wanted to be recognised. Hence, that was another reason why he said he always wore the black hat and the dark glasses and was hiding from everybody so that nobody could actually ever point out who he was.
Bill also famously said he dressed in black because it was one less decision to make in the mornings. Bill's friend, musician Kenny Clayton.
Well, here we are in the hallowed halls of the Coach and Horses called Romilly Street. On the other side of the wall is a cartoon, a Michael Heath cartoon. He did many for the Coach and Horses about the local denizens, like Jeff Bernards and... Here's one of four of the characters, one of which is Bill Mitchell at the end with his pint. They are all saying in unison,
"Oh, what we are about to receive, may the Lord make us truly thankful."
In 1975, Bill's life took another unexpected turn as he and Chris Sanford became unlikely pop stars.
Yes, Bill Mitchell and I, we had the same agent, Rex Williams, and Rex rang me one day and he said, "Listen, there's this record by Telly Savalas storming up the charts. Telly speaks the lyric of a song called If by David Gates. Do you think we could do something like it with Bill Mitchell?" And I had the idea that we should do the rehearsal. Presumably Telly Savalas and this very camp New York producer trying to get Telly not to sing.
"If a picture has a thousand words, then why can't I paint you?"
"Hold it, listen. Do you think you can do it without the lollipop in your mouth?"
"The words will never show the you I've come to know."
"Oh, it's a riff."
"And if a face could launch a thousand ships, then where am I to go?"
"Don't sing, sweetheart."
"There's no one home but you."
"Goodness."
"All that's left me, two."
"Now the chorus singers come in, they sing right along with you, and one more."
"And when, my love."
The song was a surprise hit.
Yes, we We decided we wouldn't say who we were, and we put out the rumour that we were Peter Sellers and Peter Ustinov. And so when the press wanted to meet us, the agent would say, no, you can't meet them because they're in the country writing the album, but they will call you up. And so we used to call up in character. Either Billy would ring up and say, hi, this is Jan. Or I'd go, oh, hello, sweetheart, this is Jan. What can we do for you? Complete madness.
If the world should stop revolving, spinning slowly, down to die.
Shut up.
I'd spend the end with you. And when the world was through,
he's got it. Sing, baby, sing.
Then one by one, the stars would all go out.
Gorgeous, Theo, just gorgeous. Oh, mercy.
You want one?
Oh, thank you.
Does Barry want one?
Barry, do you want a lollipop?
The interesting part was when they asked us if we do Top of the Pops, and I say, well, nobody knows who we are, so how can we do it? And we thought about it for a bit, and we decided to do it in silhouette. And because Telly Savalas had a shaved head, Billy wore a rubber thing came right down over his head to make him look bald in silhouette, and we did it. But interestingly, the 3 Degrees were on the same show, and Billy was a great one for the ladies, you know. And he said, do you see those chicks? I went, yeah, great, Billy, nice, I'm gonna have a word. I said, you reckon? He said, sure. So he goes over and has a chat, comes back mystified why he can't pull this girl, the lead singer. And I said, Billy, look in the mirror, you know.
Oh, my God, I forgot.
In the 70s, Bill's life revolved around Soho. Not only the recording studios were there, but as a lover of jazz, it offered him Ronnie Scott's. The pubs were full of entertaining company, actors, artists, newspaper people and associated bohemians, from Geoffrey Barnard to Francis Bacon. Bill would happily swap witticisms, discuss his passion for Charlie Parker or Rimbaud, or pontificate on metaphysics while he waited for the next job to find him. Film editor Xavier Russell.
In the early days in the 70s or mid-70s, I didn't actually know him, but I knew all the pubs he drank in. I remember one commercial, Thieves Are Silent, in a public place. And one of his main hangouts was the Blue Posts, which is on the corner of Berwick Street Market and Broadwick Street. And he would be in there with fellow regular drinkers Tom Baker and Robert Powell, who were also voiceover artists. And they always, in fact, the place they did most of their commercials was a place called John Woods, which is sadly now closed down. It's become a big tower block. And those three normally just went from pub to pub in between their voiceover sessions. They obviously made an absolute fortune back then.
One of his quotes was, that was the year of the Quantro, when in fact he fell in love with Quantro for a whole year, and he's not quite sure where the year went. I think that was the year he probably lost his wife.
I would call my agent to say, you know, is the next one still on, and any more today? And then they'd say, yes, can you find Bill Mitchell? I'd say, sure. So I'd have a little run round and try 3 pubs. And if he wasn't in 3 of the pubs, I knew he'd be in his flat, and maybe he didn't want to be interrupted. So I'd go and ring the intercom and say, Billy, call the agent. And there'd be a long pause and say, you know what you're interrupting, don't you, sweetheart? And I said, no, I don't want to know. Call the agent.
Okay.
In the famous denim aftershave campaign of the late 70s and early 80s, Bill's voice was unambiguously linked to sex appeal. A scarlet, taloned female hand slowly snaked down a man's blue denim shirt, partially opened to reveal a well-muscled chest beneath. Not Bill's. Sometimes the temptress even went so far as to pop open a press stud as her fingers descended, until just as her hand slipped inside the shirt, racily near the waist, a firm masculine hand stopped her in her tracks. In amongst the Curly Whirlies and Angel Delight, this was potent stuff.
We'll be right back.
aftershave that's as cool as the clothes he wears, he makes an interesting discovery. The more he puts on, the cooler he gets. Denim aftershave. For men who don't have to try too hard.
Bill rather enjoyed intimidating clients, playing up to his hard man image. But despite this and his enjoying a drink, his timing and phrasing remained superb, although reputedly always much better before lunch. Nick Angel recalls how Bill was in the studio.
At the end of a session, again, creatives, clients, thanking him and, you know, wonderful and what a great job you've done, Bill, and all of this. And Bill would just be standing in the corner of the studio folding up the script. Just before leaving, he'd put the script in his top pocket, lean into them and say, "I keep bad scripts."
Like Orson Welles, Bill's voice lent itself well to horror and the macabre, a field he tackled with great relish on several 1970s LPs. Recording a Dracula album with Christopher Lee, a Doctor Who album with drinking partner Tom Baker, and delivering a chilling solo reading of Edgar Allan Poe's Tales of Mystery and the Imagination on a double album from 1977. Here's Bill performing The Black Cat from that album.
For the most wild yet homely narrative which I am about to relate, I neither expect nor solicit belief. Mad indeed would I be to expect it, in a case where my very senses reject their own evidence. Yet mad I am not, and very surely I do not dream. But tomorrow I die, and today I would unburden my soul.
We used to do a lot of commercial sessions together for other products. One wonderful occasion was I was doing Mr. Speedy Mouth and he was doing Mr. Slow One-Liners, and we got this script and it said on it 30 seconds. In those days, commercials were 15 seconds, 30 seconds, 45 seconds, or 60 seconds. And we looked at this and I knew just by looking at it that this was 45, but it said 30 on the top. And we were trying and I was going faster and faster and faster, and Billy was going a little faster. I can't go any faster. And in the end, I said, let's have one more try, and he said, "Hang on a minute," and he got hold of me, dragged me through the door to where the producer was sitting. He took my script, put it with his script, he spun it across the desk, and he said, "When you people come to your senses, my compadre and I will be in the adjacent hostelry. There's a town full of cockneys out there. Go get yourself one. Good morning."
Similar tales abound, broadcastable and unbroadcastable, from an era when voiceover artists were thinner on the ground and thicker around Soho, and the industry seemed full of characters. Nick Angel regrets the passing of those days. And so do I.
He truly understood what was required. He understood direction, he understood intonation, he understood how to, phrase things, he understood how to use his voice, and this was always within the context of, you know, quite tight timing constraints. You know, he truly was a brilliant artist.
Sadly, as the 1980s gave way to the 90s, Bill's lifestyle began to catch up with him. In later years, Bill moved in with his friend Zoot Money, renting a room in his home.
A bit of trouble with, the internal organs. They weren't necessarily functioning the way they should, and certainly not if you drink the way that he did. We're not talking about excessive drink. It was just continuous drink. That was all it was. If you drink every day, as anyone will tell you, even if it's a small amount, obviously the organs don't, some organs just won't take it anymore. And he was in his 60s, so you certainly can't do that kind of thing at that age. And I think he was trying to find somewhere where he could be reasonably at ease with myself and my wife, who quote-unquote, understood his problems with the world.
Amanda McAllister, again.
he definitely wasn't well, and I knew he wasn't well when I came back from a holiday at Easter, and he was a complete orange colour and certainly didn't look very well at all, and wouldn't countenance or come with me or allow me to organise any kind of treatment or visiting doctors. I mean, I think he knew he had cancer. I mean, he certainly knew. I did insist when he got very poorly and lost a lot of weight that he saw somebody, and he was diagnosed. Very distressing, because on the day of his death I was in the midst of a big shoot and I wasn't able to get away to get him, and I begged my mother to go over and sort of see him into the help him get into the transport and all this sort of stuff, and he never made it. He died in her arms.
Bill Mitchell died on the 20th of August 1997.
Nice guy, and he was a great character. I think that's probably what's lacking these days. We've lost those characters. It is a different industry.
I remember Bill as the best friend one could have. Larger than life, very underrated, extremely generous, and misunderstood.
The world Bill inhabited has now disappeared, and voiceover artists are no longer rare beasts loose on the streets of Soho. There are thousands of them now, scattered all over the world, often with their own studios, able to record down the line to anywhere at a moment's notice, giving us far more voices to enjoy, but perhaps a few less characters.
Everyone's happy with Butch soap. Bath time slappy with... Wait a minute. I can't say that, man. I mean, face it, baby. I don't even play rugby. I mean, it's not really my image, you dig? I think you got the wrong guy for this gig, sweetheart. I'll see you. Ciao, baby.
Well, as you wish, but your representative and I have been talking in terms of $250,000.
Everyone's happy with Butch soap. Bath time slappy with Butch soap. Move that grime in record time with a big Butch bar of Butch soap. For the man who knows where the action is.